Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending 3rd of December 1922, a Conservative shows some backbone, Communist scheme, Field Marshal Haig gets the first of many biographies, and there's bad news for railways, battleships, prohibition, and Greek politicians. Britain is currently experiencing high unemployment. Ever eager to help, the Communists have organised a march of the unemployed to London. They have demanded a meeting with Bona Law, the Prime Minister. He's not keen. He made his feelings known in the House of Commons. This is from Wednesday the 29th. Mr. Bona Law said he was still convinced that the course he had taken was the only one open to him. It was not a good principle that when a difficulty arose, the appeal should always be made to the Prime Minister rather than to the Minister at the head of the department, which would deal with the matter. If he thought it would alleviate in the smallest degree the sufferings of the unemployed, he would spend every night of his life in seeing as many as possible of them. But that was not so. The moment he took office, he was asked to receive this deputation. He had once decided that no useful purpose could be served by seeing them, and accordingly he declined to see them. They knew before they set out that their object in coming to London could not be achieved. Nothing was to be gained by them in seeing the Prime Minister. He was not a dictator who could do anything they liked to ask him to do. He believed he was as little influenced as any man by the feeling that when he said a thing he must stick to it. Hear, hear. The men's object now, so far as their speeches showed, was to obtain a victory, so that they could go back and say, Bona Law refused to see us and we compelled him to do so. That was really the tone of all the speeches. Was it possible that any government could be carried on that system? If only Scandinavian schoolchildren was treated in a similar vein. The Times has been doing some digging into the march's organisers. This is from Monday the 27th of November 1922. Some of those who are pressing for a concession to sentiment have not sufficiently recognised that there is a good deal that is exclusively political in the insistence by the body styling itself the National Unemployed Workers Committee Movement, that its representatives should have access to the head of the government. The March of the Unemployed into London was organised as a demonstration chiefly by communists and supporters of the Red International of Trade Unions, and it can hardly be doubted that the marches are being kept here for propaganda purposes. The National Administrative Council of Unemployed, which is closely identified with the National Unemployed Workers Committee Movement, published a paper called Out of Work, offered for sale at all unemployed demonstrations. In an earlier issue of this four-page sheet, the following statement appeared. If we are able to establish that great principle of work or maintenance, we should have travelled a long way towards bringing about the abolition of capitalism. We shall have struck at the very foot of capitalist society. In fact, we shall have shattered one of the cornerstones of a system of society based upon rent, interest and profit, a system which makes unemployment a necessity, and in the crash that will follow, will be the golden opportunity of the working class to take over the means of production and distribution in the interests of the workers and not the few. People still argue over the causes of unemployment, in much the same way as they still argue about the merits of Field Marshal Haig. This has spawned any number of biographies. The first, by George Dewar, assisted by Lieutenant Colonel J.H. Boriston, was recently published. This is from Wednesday the 29th. The method adopted, he means a central argument, implies that by the British public and to an even greater extent by our French allies, scant justice has been done to the leadership of Sir Douglas Haig during the last three tremendous years of the war. That not only has a doubt existed, perhaps it would be more correct to say that ignorance had prevailed, as to his loyalty to his French colleagues, but that sufficient credit was never given to the Commander-in-Chief for his share in the conception of the great operations which provided successes at the moment when such were greatly needed, or which led directly to the ultimate victory of the Western powers. Finally, the author repeatedly calls attention to Mr. Lloyd George's interventions, not merely in the realms of strategy, from which indeed in the broad sense the statesman can never under a modern democratic regime, or any other for that matter, be wholly divorced, but his interventions in purely military plans and operations. I must confess this is a bit of a surprise to me, because my understanding was that at this point in time, Haig was as close to a national hero as you could get, the man who'd won the war. And it was only later, after his death, in the 1930s, where he came in for criticism. So I'm a bit surprised to hear that even now there are doubts being raised. When it comes to this remark about Lloyd George's interventions, I think what they probably mean, or probably is uppermost in their minds, is the what's known as the Calais Conference, in which Lloyd George tried to put the British Army under the command of the French Army. This is early in 1917, and almost led to the resignations of, well, any number of senior officers. And there were a few other things. Certainly, for a long time, it's been claimed that Lloyd George, that is, withheld troops from the Western Front. Although, I mean, even that is, there's some modern doubt has been shown on that, so I don't know. Anyway, it goes on. Among many of our countrymen, among even some of them who count themselves as students of the war, there is disposition to belittle the share English generals and staffs had in the final German overthrow, and this book was well worth publishing, if for the one purpose alone of exploding the myth that, thanks to unity of command, French genius, being at length given its chance, waved its wand and forthwith made up for years of indifferent British generalship and a senseless policy of attrition. In March 1918, when the Germans launched the Ludendorff offensive, the British Army and the French Army was put under the command of General Foch as the generalissimo or commander. This is what they're referring to here. There's an awful lot in that paragraph. To do justice to it, I think it would probably take a whole lecture on it, and I could actually give that, but I don't propose to do that here. I think I'll just keep my remarks to this. There was a desire to have a scapegoat, and Haig was made that scapegoat for all the losses in the First World War and all the misery and all the mud and what have you. And that, I think, is dreadfully unfair. It wasn't his fault that the machine gun or the barbed wire had been invented. It wasn't his fault that the war was fought where and when it was. He just had to deal with it. Sure, he made mistakes. He also got a lot of things right, which is often forgotten. Anyway, it goes on. This is a quote from the book. It is certain that if the direct intervention of cabinet ministers and politicians is henceforth to be the rule in military operations, the gift of eloquence will have to be cultivated in every school of war. It will have to be part of the education of the young officer who aspires to generalship. Debating clubs and classes may have to be made a feature of every military staff in peace, and when war breaks out, they may have more or less to take the field. How very true. 20 years later, General Alan Brooke, was made the chief of the Imperial General Staff. He kept a diary, and essentially night after night he is called in to see Churchill. Churchill will propose some idiotic scheme which just absorbs resources for no possible use, and Alan Brooke has to argue him out of it. And this just involves, you know, shouting matches. And thank goodness he did, is all I can say. So I think Dewar's probably on the right lines there. Anyway, the senior service is also looking to the future. This is a letter from Tuesday the 28th of... Oh, sorry, yes, there's been a fair amount of correspondence. This is provoked by Admiral Percy Scott. I've never heard of the guy before, but he seems to be fairly on the ball. Anyway, this is one of the letters that he's written, and this is from Tuesday the 28th. Before the war, I stated that the battleship was too vulnerable and that the submarine would prevent her carrying out most of the functions for which she was built. I considered that her day was over, and I advised that no more should be built. I consider that the late war confirmed my opinion as to the vulnerability of a battleship. This is a very interesting statement. I mean, obviously, we no longer have battleships. And it has to be said, an awful lot of battleships in the Second World War ended up at the bottom of the ocean. However, of course, they've been replaced by aircraft carriers, which in many cases are far bigger than the battleships they replaced. For instance, the current Queen Elizabeth class are bigger than are the biggest ships that the Royal Navy has ever sailed. And one would presume would be just as vulnerable as a battleship. So he's right, but he's wrong. Except, of course, I understand, according to his Wikipedia page, Scott did say that in terms of tonnage of explosive and distance, aircraft carriers just have can easily beat a battleship. So he was kind of right there. But, well, hey, making predictions about the future is very difficult. Anyway, and now it is time for Stats Corner. I mentioned earlier the problem with unemployment, and there are all sorts of letters being written to the Times, say, having this scheme and that scheme. A lot involve roads, a lot involve railways. This is from Lord Montagu of Beaulieu, yes, the guy who runs, or presumably the predecessor of the guy who runs the museum down in on the south coast, somewhere in the New Forest. Well, Beaulieu, actually. This is what he has to say. It comes up with a very interesting stat. Turning to another aspect of road... this is from Monday, the 27th of November. Turning to another aspect of road traffic, we find that the railways in the United Kingdom in 1921, carried 101,841,804 tons of goods, or a decrease of 31.4% as compared with 1920. Even allowing for the coal strike and slackness of trade, I didn't know there was a coal strike, obviously there was, it is impossible to resist the conclusion that much of this traffic has reverted to the roads, and at least 33% has done so, or something like 34 million tons a year. This has happened partly owing to the greater speediness, convenience and cheapness of conveyance by road, and partly owing to causes such as pilferage, common in one case and rare in the other. I must confess, I wasn't aware that pilferage was such a problem, but that decline of 30% is incredible and ominous. It's worth pointing out, in those days, freight was by far the largest share of railway revenues. Well, obviously not the London Underground railways, but you know, for most of them. So a decline is really worrying. One of the big complaints is often made by sort of railway enthusiasts is in this time there was something called the Common Carrier legislation in which railways had to publish their rates. So it was a very easy business for road hauliers just to undercut them. But I think I've always thought that there's probably more to it than that, and Beaulieu suggests some. But I really had no idea that pilferage was such a problem in the case of railways. Maybe that's something that containerization could change. I believe that containerization has been massive, has improved pilferage, the problem with pilferage massively on the I was going to say high seas. That's pompous. I can't think of a better way in sea cargo. But well, we don't have an awful lot of containerization in this country, and I very much doubt it's ever going to happen. Anyway, something that's not in decline is American alcohol consumption. This is from Wednesday the 29th. The failure of prohibition to prohibit is causing the government increasing concern. The whole subject was considered at a cabinet meeting recently. The facts and figures cited at this meeting are said to have appalled the president, who regarded the situation as so serious that he was with difficulty dissuaded from issuing a proclamation appealing to the wealthier classes of the nation to abandon their present defiance of the law. I'll go on. According to statements attributed to the Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Mellon, the enforcement of the law is impossible, even if an army of prohibition officials be employed in the task, because, as he points out, the bribes offered them to ignore their duties are beyond the dreams of avarice. Information reaching the administration is to the effect that whiskey, wines and other intoxicating beverages are now flowing in torrents over all the borders of the United States. I noticed they don't mention beer. Maybe beer or American beer doesn't count as an intoxicating beverage. Anyway, last week I referred to the scourge of the Ku Klux Klan in Louisiana, but that's not the only state so afflicted. This is also from Wednesday the 29th. Urgent appeals are being addressed to the government to employ the authority of the federal courts to disband the Ku Klux Klan. According to Senator Walsh, the members of this secret organisation, clad in their white robes and with caps covering their faces, have in the last 18 months in Texas alone conducted no less than 500 tar and feather parties and whipping bees, besides committing many homicides and other crimes. Tar and feather parties, eh? In Maryland, within the last few days, men wearing the insignia of Ku Klux have raided the houses of two couples known to be unmarried and compelled them under pain of whipping to secure benefit of clergy. The order describes itself as an organization of 100% Americans. Its officers declare it is necessary to fight the secret organizations of Jews and Roman Catholics. They are waging war, they say, against MAC, meaning the Irish Roman Catholics, declaring that these initials stand for Make America Catholic. I didn't realise that President Trump lifted his best-known slogan from a foe of the Ku Klux Klan, albeit an imaginary one. Still, just as well America doesn't have secret and uniformed societies whose members disguise their identities to assault imagined enemies these days. One thing that is not imaginary is the Greeks' firing squad. After Greece's defeat in its war with Turkey, a coup removed the previous government and exiled the king. The new government put six members of the former government on trial for treason. They were found guilty and shot. In response, Britain withdrew its ambassador. This is from Wednesday the 29th, and it's an editorial. This act is strongly to be condemned in the interests of Greece herself. These are not the methods by which the disaster of defeat can be wiped out and the new regime established securely. The Revolutionary Committee have incurred the gravest risks in carrying out what must be regarded as an act of political vengeance at a moment when their country more than ever needs support and aid. My first reaction when I read something like that is to ask the question, well, is the times right here? And it's kind of difficult to say. Greece remains pretty unstable. In fact, its last coup was in 1975, I suppose, 74, 75. But from the point of view of the coup leaders, well, it seems that the main ones died in old age, albeit one of them in exile. So it seems they got away with it. Not that I'm giving pointers or anything like that, but interesting. And now the sport. This is from Monday the 27th. The Beaufort met at Bidderstone on Saturday. A fox from Corsham Park soon ran hounds out of scent. Another fox from Derriads was hunted towards Corsham, and then backwards and forwards until killed near the starting point. A Heywood fox went away towards Corsham and was not pursued. Late in the afternoon, hounds ran well with an outlier found near Allington Gorse. Turning left-handed through Heywood, hounds ran past Allington to Caston Piercy, I'm pretty sure that's Easton Piercy, and Lee Delamere Woods. After a double ring in this neighbourhood, hounds were stopped. And I think some people watch football. Anyway, that's enough for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.